Hello, welcome to episode 21 of the Wilder podcast. This week, we speak to the wonderfully inspiring Mary Colwell. She tells us a story of the curlew, why they're so special, why they're in decline, and how we can help. And that leads us nicely into the importance of nature literacy and the role of the newly proposed Natural History GCSE, which Mary played a critical role in establishing. Chloe, hello.
Hello, everybody.
Right, well, I realised last week that we didn't actually give a quick overview of who we are before we went into the chat. And I think that's remiss of us. So shall we fix that this time around?
Yeah, absolutely.
So welcome, listener. If you are new to the Wilder podcast, I'm Tom Constable and this is my wife, Chloe.
Hi.
We are on a wonderful journey to restore nature to our 80 acres in Monmouthshire, a farm here. But also, as we were complete amateurs just a year ago, we're here to educate ourselves on the importance of nature, restoring nature, and how best we can aid sustainability and obviously fight climate change as well. And each week we get amazing guests on, and it's wonderful, isn't it?
It's been a fantastic journey so far.
I mean, that's basically what we do. But we also give an update as to the project. Now, there's plenty to talk about, and I'm trying to keep it as succinct as possible. So planning, there's no update on our education centre in terms of the planning we're trying to achieve. What we've, Chloe and I have decided to do is not talk about planning going forward until we get it. I think it would be...
Yeah, it's depressing for us. It's going to be depressing for everyone.
Yeah, and boring, repetitive. So let's just wait till we get it. We're still confident. It's just going to take time, basically. Chloe, would you like to update on Project Pig?
Yeah, I guess for those that aren't familiar with the concept of Project Pig, Tom got inspired after a visit to a rewilding site in Mid Wales that what we needed in our lives, or more specifically what the Grange project needed, was two pigs to help us create ecological disturbance across the site. So we put out a plea via the podcast for anyone with any pig expertise to give us a hand. And we were delighted a couple of weeks ago to be invited to one of our podcast listeners' homes who have had pigs in various capacities over the last 15 years. And they gave us the beginner's guide to pig husbandry. And our new arrivals are coming next month.
And what breed are they?
British Saddlebacks. They're quite big.
They are quite big. Yeah, a little bit intimidating. Mm-hmm. It'll be fine. It'll be great. Think of the disturbance they're going to be doing.
So we're busy, with the help of our listener and Google, trying to work out what we need, how we look after them. And I've joined a WhatsApp pig group called Pastured Pigs, which also helps me with various pig-related questions.
Thank you, Paul, for all your advice and an amazing watermill. But that's another story. So the final update we've got before we go into the main effort with Mary is that a few episodes back, listeners will remember that we interviewed the team from Young Wilders, which is a youth-led organisation focusing on allowing access to the younger generation to learn all about nature recovery and rewilding. Over the last few weeks, we've had a number of discussions with them, and we're very, very happy to announce that we're going to be offering up 30 acres of the Grange project to Young Wilders to allow them to, again, do what they do best, which is do youth engagement within Wales. Will be for us. Obviously, they do it across the UK. As part of that, we're on the lookout for somebody, aren't we, Chloe?
We are. We are looking for two wild stewards. Now, what is a wild steward, you may ask? It is a young person aged 18 to 25 in the Young Wilders definition of, who will come and work with Young Wilders and us for about 12 months. And over that time, they'll be doing a day a month. And the amazing thing is it's a paid role and they're going to be learning about nature recovery through a lot of the expertise that's held within Young Wilders. And they're going to be coming and helping with practical activities on the land, facilitating volunteers days, helping us with surveys, getting involved with interventions, anything really that helps promote youth engagement with the project.
No experience is necessary. Obviously, that does help. And also, that age bracket is semi-flexible for the right person as well, from what we remember. But we're really excited because this literally is one of the pillars of what we want to do, isn't it? What an opportunity.
Absolutely. And if anyone is interested, you need to reach out to Jack at Young Wilders and we'll put details of that in the show notes.
Right. Should we get into a chat with Mary?
Let's do that. So Mary Colwell is a writer, producer, conservationist, public speaker, and the driving force behind Curlew Action.
Welcome, Mary, to the Wilder podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're very fortunate because we're aware that you are out travelling at the moment and you've taken your time to pull over and take this call with us in this chat. So thank you very much for giving us your time.
Not at all. And I apologise in advance for the sound of my voice. I do sound like I smoke a lot of cigarettes, but I've just had a cold. So
yeah. No, well, doubly thankful that you're doing this now then.
No problem.
So before we start, as is tradition, would you mind introducing yourself, those may not have come across you, a little bit about your background and how you find yourself doing what you do now?
Oh, it's quite a big question, actually. So I suppose I started off, my main career was as a producer at the BBC Natural History Unit. I made wildlife films and radio programmes. And then I left that quite a long time ago now and wanted to be more active in saving things, not just showing things, and started to work a lot with world religions and conservation. And then the plight of the curlew really caught my attention. And I decided to try and do whatever I could to help the curlew. I also decided to do whatever I could to help people understand why it's important we save birds like curlew and everything else. So nature education and the GCSE in natural history took an equal standing alongside what I do, alongside all my curlew work. And I write books as well and do podcasts.
Yeah, lots of podcasts. If you have a look at Mary's website, which will be in the show notes, a little bit intimidated. That's really interesting. Both of those topics we're going to be covering is the curlew, and we're basically going to go for curlew 101 here because it's an animal that Chloe and I both know very little about, to our shame, and you're here to help us with that. And the natural history GCSE is something that Chloe and I have, talk about the importance of educating the younger generation and why that will make the difference in a generation's time. And it's important to start now, and especially because when I left the military, I actually trained as a teacher for a year as well. So it's a topic very close to my heart. Shall we start with the curlew?
Yes, let's start with the curlew.
It is going to be a really basic question, but what is a curlew? What does it look like? And why did they sing to you, maybe literally? and why did you choose to focus on them?
What is a curlew? A curlew is Europe's largest wading bird. So that means it likes water. It likes water, damp, wet places, very often to feed. It's a ground nesting bird, and it's about the size of a mallard duck, if you can imagine a mallard duck type body, but it's got a really long neck and really long legs to wander around in that water. But its defining feature, I think, is its beautiful, long, downward curving bill. They're really sculptural in form. It looks a bit like the bow that an archer would use, and hence its name, Numenius arquata. Numenius means new moon, that crescent shape of the moon, and arquata means shaped like a bow. So the curlew's Latin name refers to this beautiful long bill, which can be 20 centimetres long. So it's a large wading bird, long skinny legs, long skinny neck, little tiny pinhead, beautiful long bill, and it's the colour of sort of browns and greys and creams. And when you see them, you literally can't help but love them. I mean, to know them is to love them. And so they're beautiful enough to look at, but when they open that long bill and sing, oh my goodness, do they go straight to your soul? That lovely, haunting, bubbling call, which they make mainly in the springtime. And if you're out and about in the moors and meadows where there are curlews, it's a song that really stirs you. In fact, I defy anybody to not hear a curlew and literally stop and listen. If you hear it, you can't just carry on walking and think, oh, there's a curlew. You literally stop because it's such an arresting sound. It's such a magical sound. So it's the look of them, the sound of them, and the sound has inspired writers and poets and musicians through the ages. But I also love where they live. I love the estuaries and the coastlines where they go in the winter, where they use that long bill to get into mud and inaccessible places and eat all the sort of yummy worms and crabs and things. I love that. I love those liminal places between the land and the sea. And then I love that they'll nest in something as prosaic as a muddy farmer's field or somewhere as wild and wonderful as a moor. So they just press every button for me, I think.
That's beautiful. And what I'm going to try and do is cut in a call or a call from the curlew, a song from the curlew into this podcast now for those like me and Chloe, I'm sure, that probably have never heard it. So we'll cut that in now. That genuinely was like hearing a picture, painting me this picture with it. So thank you very much for that. I assume that their numbers aren't growing, which is why you feel like you needed to take action. So Would you be able to talk a bit more about the plight and why they are endangered or numbers are going down or threatened?
Yes, absolutely. The numbers are going down. And the reason they're going down is they're just not producing enough chicks. The bottom line is they come back to their breeding grounds year on year, but most of them are not fledging chicks. If they do, if they get to adults, they're surviving really well. So it's the production of chicks where the issue is. So that focuses down and makes us look at the reasons why they're declining. So they nest on the ground. Like I said, they lay 4 eggs directly onto the soil or the grass.
Right.
And that leaves them completely vulnerable because everything we do on the ground. We farm it. We build houses on it. We put our factories on it. We drain it for crops. We walk over it. We walk our dogs on it. We drive across it. We do everything. We plant trees on it. So everything we do affects curlews. So in the farmers' fields, when they nested a few decades ago in meadows that were cut late in the harvest time in July, August, they'd had time to lay their eggs in April and bring up their young. So by the time the mowers came in, their young were fledged. That doesn't happen anymore. On most fields, they have been converted to silage, to grass, to grow, to feed animals. And silage can be cut as frequently as every 8 weeks, starting in April. So from the minute, really, they arrive, they're under threat from silage cutting if they're in these lowland grassy fields. If they're everywhere they nest, whether it's in lowland fields or whether it's more of the sort of upland fringes, they're open to vulnerable to high levels of predation. Because of our very urban and our very intensive land use, predators like foxes and crows and badgers do really, really well. We have the highest density of foxes and crows of anywhere in Europe. They just love the sort of intensive landscape, rich in all sorts of food, which they can make the most of. So there's lots of predators out there that are only too happy to eat a pizza 1 second and a curlew the next. So they're generalist predators and they can really do serious damage to dwindling populations. When there's lots of curlews, they chase them all off and make a big fuss and lots of noise and the predators go elsewhere. But when you're down to just a handful of pairs, that doesn't really work. So they high levels of predation, lots of agriculture. A big push at the moment is to plant as many trees as possible. And we need lots more trees. That's absolutely not in question. The question is, where do we put those trees? And a lot of the places cited for, say, plantations are on the rough upland grasslands because they're not productive for food. So you may as well plant trees there. And that's exactly where most of our curlews are nesting. So forestry, predation, agricultural techniques, as well as dog walking, maybe housing development, increase in arable crops, which drains the land, that kind of thing, which makes it hard for them to feed. Maybe also the general decline in insect populations, because the insects, so the chicks need just insects. They eat insects when they're babies. So there's lots of things. The modern world isn't kind to curlews.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Mary, because there's all those systemic influences and is telling the story of the impact that has on one, which sounds like a very special bird. I mean, it's got me curious. We've got an 80-acre farm, which is a lowland farm. It's pretty wet. It's clay. It's a lot of water. It makes me think, you know, would there one day have been curlews there? It was for the last X many years. It's just had a silage crop taken off it. So it makes me wonder about where we're most likely to find curlews now if we went looking for them.
Whereabouts are you in the country?
So we're in Wales, Monmouthshire.
Okay, so Wales is doing particularly badly, I have to say. Sorry, but Wales is, along with Southern Ireland, you can put on the very dubious crown of having the biggest losses of curlews over the last 20 years, I know. You've probably lost 80 to 90% of your curlews in Wales, and there are probably only between 300 and 400 pairs left in the whole country, and that's down from thousands in the 90s. And the reason that in Wales is particularly badly hit was that curlews really in Wales nested in the uplands. And when headage was introduced, headage was when the farmers got paid for the number of sheep that they were grazing. Sheep numbers drastically went up. Quite a lot of the uplands started to look like billiard tables, really. And that exposes the birds to predators. They don't like nesting on very exposed places. Sheep dip doesn't do an awful lot of good. The insects, all sorts of reasons. So Wales has intensified greatly in the lowlands. It's had a big increase in sheep in the uplands. And a double whammy really has really affected them in Wales. Your hot spots, we'd have to go to North Wales, a bit of a way away from you.
Well, it sounds like it'd be worth the visit. Connected to them now, just from your initial description. And I guess for us, with our rewilding project, or for people thinking more generally about, my assumption is it's going to need to be a systemic solution to address the systemic problem. But what are some of your thoughts around how we can rescue the curlews from the plight?
Okay, I think the first thing to say is it might have sounded a bit like I was blaming farmers in the previous answer. I'm not blaming the farming community at all. Farmers only do what we ask of them and pay them to do. And so this is a societal issue. So we have to work with the farming community to say, how can we make it work for you? How can you carry on doing that vital job of producing food, but also really care for the wildlife that uses your land? What kind of payment systems do you need? What kind of compensation can we put in place? Can we advise you better on agricultural schemes, on different ways of mowing the land, and maybe having some kind of sharing of silage scheme with neighbouring farms? Something. But there must be ways that we can work with farmers, led by them, to say, this is how we can live alongside each other. That's an absolute priority in the uplands and in the lowlands. I think as well, it's a hard topic to discuss, and I get it 100%, but curlews are being eaten to extinction. So we do need to have a grown-up and sensible conversation about where we have these dwindling populations. What sort of predator control can we put in place, or should we put in place? We have to make that decision between us. So foxes and crows are the main culprits, we seem to think, at the moment. So can we just exclude them with fences, or does there need to be some level of lethal control? And that's a conversation we desperately need to have and make decisions about. And we also need everybody to get on side, to understand what's happening in the countryside, to learn about curlews, to love them, tell people about them, to educate in the widest possible way that curlews are what good looks like. If you've got curlews and they're producing chicks, you're doing something right. Your landscape is healthy, not just for curlews, but for flowers and meadows and insects and other birds and other creatures that use those habitats. So this is not just about the curlew. This is about the wider societal health. This is about wider environmental health of our landscapes. So there's lots of things we can do, from education to working with farmers to the right policies. But we haven't got much time. And in some places, we may well be too late. But we can do it. It's not a matter of we don't know what to do. It's a matter of do we want to do it.
I really appreciate your description there about a curlew being obviously part of a mosaic and showing the health of a habitat. But I also think it's really critical that we tell stories that engage people. I think the story of a bird like the curlew helps to do that engagement piece. And I know that you've done a few activities in your time to kind of help promote this story. So I wonder whether you can tell us a little bit about some of those activities.
A variety of things, really. I discovered, Wales, you have the patron saint of curlews in Wales. You do. You have an amazing 7th century preacher called St. Beuno. And St. Beuno, I think in Welsh it's Beuno, B-E-U-N. Long time ago, he is credited with converting Wales to Christianity. And he used to go around, particularly West Wales, and preach. And one day he was sailing between the Lynn Peninsula and Anglesey. And legend tells us that he dropped his prayer books into the sea and in a storm. And he was so distraught. But then a curlew flew out from the shore, picked up the books, took them back to the shore to dry. And St. Beuno was so grateful to the curlew that he blessed it and said, may your eggs always be difficult to find. And so from then on, curlews have been really difficult, which is a blessing for the curlew and a curse for curlew field workers, because they are really hard to find. But you have the patron, and just telling a story like that, a fantastical legend, but it's very engaging and it's very lovely. And it weaves the curlew into our spiritual beliefs and our folklore as well. The other thing I do is I've joined forces with the singer-songwriter David Gray, really great songwriter. White Ladder was one of the best-selling albums, and he's still amazingly active. And few people know a lifelong naturalist. And he contacted me and said, I love curlews, how can I help? And he and I do these musical evenings where we have a conversation about what nature means to him, how it's really infiltrated through all his music. And then he gets up and plays live music in front of the audience. They're magical evenings, absolutely magical. Oh. And they help us get in a wider audience as well. A couple of things there for curlews. as well as the GCSE in natural history, which I hope will sneak a curlew in.
How long have you been actively trying to support and promote protecting the curlew for now?
At the end of 2015, a paper came out in a magazine called British Birds, which really only hardcore birders read. So you have to be quite dedicated to read British Birds. But it was a paper that said the decline in curlew is so precipitous it should be considered the most pressing conservation priority in the UK. That came as a real shock. That came out at the end of 2015. So in April 2016, I decided that I would do a 500-mile walk from the west of Ireland, all the way through Ireland, all the way through Wales, and right across England to end up at the Wash in East Anglia. And across that 500-mile walk, I would go to places where the curlew still exists, and you can still stand by a stone wall and listen to it singing. I wanted to go to the places where the meadows have fallen silent and listen to that silence. I wanted to talk to the scientists and the conservationists and the bird watchers, but also the poets and the artists and the singer-songwriters, and say, what is it? What does the curlew mean to you? Why do you think it's disappearing? Do you think you can help bring it back? So that walk then was a really important stepping stone to a whole load of initiatives. I organised, straight after that walk, I organised 4 national conferences where I brought together a whole sector of conservationists, from the shooting fraternity through to sort of RSPB and so on, the BTO, Natural England, policymakers. We had 4 of those. We had a meeting in 10 Downing Street. Very recently, my little charity Curlew Action organised a meeting of European curlew field workers, where we had people from Finland to Ireland came to work with them. So I've been hard at it for curlews since 2016, I would say.
I feel really inspired, and it really reminds me about how if you've got a passion for something, what you can achieve with that passion, and it sounds like your creativity about thinking about how do we do this in a slightly outside the box way, as opposed to maybe a traditional route of bringing in the kind of art alongside the science. So thank you. Alongside that campaigning, what positive changes have you seen over that time?
Well, the increase in the number of projects working on curlews has been amazing since 2016. They're really common bird now for projects. They get lots of money, particularly across Europe. The RSPB have done some big projects. WCT have, WWT have. There's all sorts of people doing real serious conservation and science work on curlews now. But we've also seen an uptick in the social engagement with curlews. And every year, Curlew Action runs a poetry and art competition. And we've had some of the most beautiful entries written by people. Some of them literally bring tears to your eyes. The way people express their love of curlews is really extraordinary to me. And this year, we had a beautiful entry into the art competition from a young woman who's 23, who has autism, but also is paralyzed. She can only paint with her mouth. And she painted this curlew, which is extraordinarily lovely. And she wrote, got someone to send us a message, her mum, to say, thank you for raising awareness about curlews, because when I'm taken outside, and she obviously lives near where there are some, she said, and I hear their song, in my head I do a curlew dance. I honestly, talk about wanting to make you break down in tears.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
So the engagement politically, it's gone up the political agenda. One of the only 2 birds mentioned in the government's 25-year environment plan. It's really considered on the political and policy agenda now. It's socially got a lot more traction, and more people seem to know about curlews and their plight, although we've got a lot more to do on that one, and in the conservation world with real practical projects. So there's lots to be hopeful for. There is.
What you've achieved, and I'm sure it's not just yourself, I'm sure there's the whole group of amazingly, dedicated people to it. So, thank you for what you're doing. The work you've done is enough for a lifetime. You haven't just stopped there. You've also moved into looking into supporting education, GCSE, natural history, which we'll go on to talk about. But before we step into that side of the conversation, is there anything else you'd like to add, or any advice for anyone looking to help support on the conservation side?
I think there is just one piece of advice, if I could give a piece of advice, is that, sometimes the problems of the natural world are so overwhelming, and they can be really crushing at times. And you really feel, well, what can one person do? But can I urge you not to think that? Can I urge you to put your faith in what you love? So just pick something to love and just love it. Love it with every fibre of your being. If you really care about someone, I don't mean love in some mushy, sentimental way. I mean love in a way that, well, we all know if we've got families and children of our own or whatever, that never comes easy. It always asks a lot of you. And if you're prepared to put yourself out there, be uncomfortable, be vulnerable, do all the hard work, but just because you love something, then you will be absolutely amazed what happens and who comes to walk with you. So that would be my piece of advice.
So I'm speechless. I mean, my thought as you were saying that was like, I need you is like every morning, have a little pep talk next to me. That'd be wonderful if I could bottle that up and go, right, I'm gonna smash today. It's going to be amazing. So just moving into this conversation around GCSE, just to set context from our perspective, Chloe and I obviously have three young kids. And we are fully aware of the impact that when they come back from school or nursery, wherever they've been, and say, why are you doing X or what about Y? It has a huge impact on us as parents, thinking about how do we make sure we bring them up properly and make sure we give them the right value set. And so, you know, Chloe and I talk about the value of importance of educating early on so that we can then bring up a generation of people that actually understand the importance of nature. We feel that there is a over-reliance on waiting towards more capitalist preferences within school and teaching about success equals being popular, having money. That's now what success looks like in schools, whether it's overtly or indirectly taught or as suggested. So Chloe and I, if we could wave our magic wand, we'd love to see a way of balancing that out to create a more holistic approach to education where it's about generating balance and being balanced in nature, in body, in mind, etc. So that's the background from Chloe and I. I suppose I'd love to hear what made you take on the next challenge, which is looking to get natural history in the curriculum.
I actually don't know what spurred me on, but other than a growing awareness that lots and lots of people don't really know what anything is, you know, even common blue tits or great tits or wrens or something. It was amazing how few people can actually name them, let alone wildflowers and trees. And I'm not very good at wildflowers and trees, so I'm not being arrogant here. I put myself into that category too. And I just thought that it's so important that we understand who we live with, that we live in a community of other creatures and other plants that live and breathe and have their being right alongside us. And we need to know who they are, not just because it enriches you spiritually and intellectually. It enriches you to know you're part of a beautiful natural world, but also because the natural world tells us what's going on. They're giving us messages all the time. They're telling us how the climate's changing. They're telling us if the soil's healthy. They're telling us if the air is polluted. They're just telling us what we're doing to the planet. So we need it for who we are as people. So we need it, and by it I mean a relationship with nature. We need a relationship with nature because it's good for us. But we need a relationship with nature if we're going to survive this next century, because we are not independent of it. It's not just a diorama. It's not just a backdrop that you go and say, well, that's nice on holiday. It's absolutely fundamental to our success as a species on this earth. So that was why the real just sort of disappointment at how far we've slipped away from a conversation with nature, a real valuable conversation with nature that we don't even know its name anymore. That's why.
I think it's really interesting, that idea of what relationship you hold with nature. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, yeah, I love nature. Like, it's a really important part of my life. I love spending time outdoors. I go for lots of walks. But I didn't really have a relationship with nature. I just walked through it in a way that I was quite disengaged from it. And even just in the last year, where Tom and I have really turned towards trying to connect more and understand more the ecology around us, it's amazing, I guess, the gratitude I feel now when I walk out in the morning and I hear the birds sing and I think, wow, like, not only is it an inspiring sound, but I'm like, what are you doing here, bird? What part are you playing in the system, and how can I help you? And the kind of interrelationship and that knowledge is, yeah, it's really uplifting, generally, I would say, to have that kind of sense of connection. And how do you hope that Natural History GCSE will kind of engage young people in that way? Well, if in 5 years' time the Natural History GCSE was across the curriculum in all schools, what would you hope would be the kind of shifts as a result of that?
What I would hope is that the next generation see nature as something that absolutely enchants them. The other day I was walking down, I live right in the middle of a city. I live in the middle of Bristol. And there's a street that goes down side of my house, and it often has lots of weeds, so-called, growing up, but they're lovely wildflowers to me. But the kids coming out of the school at the top of the hill and going down to the council flats at the bottom of the hill, one of them just suddenly stopped And they're always swearing and shouting and chucking their rubbish about. But one of them just suddenly stopped and he knelt down and he just looked at this flower. And for this fleeting second, I had a vision of what I wanted in the future. Didn't last long because his mates were going, oh, come on, you know, and off he went. But just for that second, I thought, maybe the next generation can see that beauty and that wonder and wonder what that flower is and why it's there and what it supports. And maybe I could go home and write a song about it or draw a picture or do something, just engage with it. So I want young people to have that enchantment that you described, that curiosity that you described, that sense of this world is extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And every day there are miracles all around you. But also to know that to understand the natural world will also help them get on. That can't just be a nice thing. It's got to be fundamental. The green economy is on us. Biodiversity net gain is now law. Companies are going to be asked to show they are biodiversity positive, that they are nature positive, that there are nature positive solutions to the impacts that industry has on the planet. And they're going to be part of that. They're going to be part of that new green world where nature has to be part of what business and industry is all about, what the economy is all about. So I want them also to see that understanding nature is going to be good for the future and their jobs and their prospects. It's got to be both. It's got to be practical and it's got to be joyful.
I love when people tell stories like that. And I think that I'll hold on to that image of that young person looking at that wildflower. So thank you. For those of us that have never tried to introduce a GCSE into a curriculum, how on earth do you go about it? What are the steps involved?
I suppose the listener couldn't see me just banging my head against the wall there. If you'd said to me 10 years ago, well, now it's 12 years ago, what it's going to be like to actually get success, would I have done it? Not sure I would. but luckily we don't have a ball like that. You just have to not give in. Just don't damn well give in. Just there's so many naysayers out there. There are so many people being cynical and negative and you'll never do it. It's going to be awful and you know, and there are far more important things to do and the government isn't interested and you knock on doors that remain firmly shut and, oh, every single barrier you can think of gets put in your way. And you just have to turn on that bloody-minded gene and just, I look on it a little bit like a river and you just want to get to the sea. You want to get to this goal, which is a nature-literate society. And all along the way, there are going to be massive boulders that are going to be rolled into the path of this river to stop you. And you know what? Water just has a way, doesn't it, of getting round the outside, flowing over the top, tunneling underneath, whatever it is, wearing it away in time. And eventually that barrier is irrelevant and you carry on and you keep going. And that's how it's been. So you just keep your eye on the goal. And at times, and I can remember them very vividly, actually, one day sitting at my desk. And the GCSE in natural history was like number 4 on a pile of things that I knew I wanted to give attention to. And I kept putting it down at the bottom because I wasn't getting anywhere. And there's just this overwhelmingly strong feeling of you just can't let your feelings stop you doing what you know is right. No matter how negative it feels or how heavy it feels, you can't let that stop you. And that's true in all of life, isn't it? For anything that you really care about, you just keep going because there is no option. So I recently walked the Camino de Santiago, which is a big pilgrimage route. And there are lots of times, anybody's done a big long walk, it doesn't have to be a pilgrimage, but a big long walk, something like that. There are loads of times where you just think, I think I'll go and find a tea shop and then get the bus home. but you don't. And I didn't. So, and eventually in 2022, on World Curlew Day, isn't that amazing? The government announced that it would be going ahead, it had agreed to a GCSE in natural history. That was on the April the 21st, 2022. We're now heading up to April the 21st, 2024, and I think that the next stage will be decided in the next week, i.e. it will go on to the next stage, which makes it very close to becoming a reality in schools. So we'll see it in schools either in 2025 or at the latest 2026. So it will get there. I have no doubt now. It has got through the biggest barriers that it's got to get through. And now it's a lot of crossing the T's and dotting the I's, but we will have it in schools. And all I can hope now is that schools get ready, get the support they need to teach it, and all systems go to rolling it out across the country.
Yeah.
That's great. Am I the only person that is now hugely curious about Mary's priority list? If this was number four, what were the other ones? Apart from the Cooney, which I could guess where that is, but that's fascinating. I also really appreciated your creating a nature literate society. That's a phrase I haven't heard before, and I think that's actually really good. I think that's going to stick with me because that is really important because of the threats we've got that are here now, but certainly coming on the horizon. Having a nature literate society will help people to understand the changes that need to be made and help put the pieces of the puzzle together to understand why it's happening. I just think that it's a no-brainer and it needs to happen. I'm sure that was part of the argument. My final question out of these 3 points I'm making is, so where next? I mean, GCSE, that's a good. You've got that in the bag, as I'm sure you're thinking it should cross the whole curriculum, you know, starting from nursery all the way through. So is that something you want to take on your shoulders or is someone else taking the baton for that?
Oh, no. I'm still going on. So the GCSE I see as one stepping stone in a much longer pathway. So fantastic. It's a key stepping stone, the GCSE. But we need to have, what do you go on to once you've done that qualification? We need an A-level. We need training courses at all levels. We need all industry and business to teach their employees the importance of understanding nature and whatever it is that they're working with. So there's a whole nature pathway, of which the GCSE is one section. And we have to get people trained up and have the tools and resources they need to be able to do that. So that's why I'm working now on something called the Nature Pathway, of which the GCSE is this section, and encouraging people to donate to help us set up nature hubs around the country, which will connect whatever need is out there, whether that's a school, a primary school, a secondary school, a business, a big industry, whatever, to the local nature, to online resources, to advice from local naturalists, to information about what's going on in wider society. We've got to do that because we're a long way from being ready for this nature literate society. But we can do it. We just have to get on and do it, and do it now.
Exactly. Music to my ears, to be honest. One thing for all the teachers out there. So when I left the military, I obviously became this teacher, a computer science teacher. And that was just when they brought in the new computer science curriculum. Now, I was teaching myself Python programming from a book while I was in Afghanistan. That was my level of competence when it came to programming. And I was going in, and the school that I went into, I was bowled over by the lack of support for a new curriculum that was there. I was known as the IT guy, the computer guy, and was teaching the other IT teachers how to do Python programming and other stuff. And that was because I self-taught myself. And I was very surprised to find out, and maybe that's changed now, but I doubt it, that the curriculum doesn't come with a set of resources for teachers. And I find that baffling. Yeah, I understand there are amazing teachers out there that can create their own resources, and great. And if you're those teachers, you want to create your own resources, do it. But why isn't there a baseline set of resources, a baseline set of differentiated lessons, homework that can help teachers so they make sure that the baseline quality of teaching any of the subject is of a higher standard than may normally be produced. So if there's time, if there's budget in the charity or whatever, if we can create a free to use all singing or dancing bit of resources for that, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And thanks for saying that, because I will use what you've just said. When your podcast comes out, I'm going to use that and put it in front of all the people who make these decisions, because it's all down to money and priority. It's as simple as that, really.
Yeah. The teachers that I was with were buying their own resources in from private companies. So actually, for a very small amount of investment, if you centralize these resource creation hubs, to there's not that many qualifications, really. Relatively speaking, on a national level. And then the improvement, in my opinion, in teaching and the relief of pressure from teachers to allow them to do all the 400 other things that they're doing. And by the way, by the end of that year that I did as a teacher, I'd rather have gone back to Afghanistan. That's how hard it is to be a teacher. When you care, when you truly want to make a difference, the pressure of being a teacher is humongous. And I think they're wonderful people, every single one of them.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm hugely passionate about that. And I found someone now I can talk to about it. So thank you.
I totally agree with you. We've got to make it easy to do this, easy and affordable. And one deputy head of a secondary school said to me, you know, he said, it's a great idea, but most of my pupils don't even have wellies or an outdoor coat that would be suitable to do field work. So how are we going to crack that one? It's just money. It's money and making it accessible. And we can do it. You know, there's nature pathway, these nature hubs that we want to set up. We'll do that. And it's when the big scheme of things, it's not much money. And there's plenty of resources, but no one's drawing them all together and saying, you need this to teach that section of the GCSE, whether it's flower identification or habitat assessment or whatever it is. These are the resources you need. At the moment, it's just, oh, this is so confusing out there. So we just got to make it happen. And honestly, I might not succeed, but I'm going to damn well try and make it happen.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for giving us that 45 minutes of your very precious time, because I love the conversation. I love your persistence, your passion, your creativity. And speaking of a clinical psychologist, your willingness to tolerate emotional discomfort along that journey, I think, is a really critical message, because we're going to all have to do that if we want to work towards the world that brings us the joy of that child looking at that wildflower or that kind of connectivity with nature. So thank you. We normally ask our guests where they would want to signpost listeners to if they want to find out more or if they want to get involved with any of your work. So what would your suggestions be about what they could look out for?
It's very good timing, actually, because the GCSE in Natural History, the content of it goes out to the public for a public assessment, and it's available this week. So I would really urge people to go on the Department for Education website, OCR, the exam board, OCR website, look at the content. And if you've got any comments, any that you'd like to add, please, please do that. Also, April the 21st, just missed it this year, but perfect time to start planning for next year. Get involved in curlew conservation, whether it's just as writing yourself a poem, giving a talk, joining a conservation group, you know, whatever it is, supporting curlew action. How about that? And enter our poetry and art competition. And this year we have a very special category, which is the curlew bake-off. And people have been sending us in their pictures of curlew inspired cakes. And some of them literally look so amazing. So and some of them look a bit more like toucans. That's okay.
I got to say, that was one thing that caught my eye when I went to your website. Like, oh, they look nice.
Exactly. We do. Lots to do on every level.
Well, thank you very much. And I generally can't wait to continue the conversation.
Thanks very much for having me.
Before we get into our actual reflections on the interview, I'm just going to take Tom off his high horse and put him back down on the ground.
I'm not sure. Was it a high horse? Or was it appropriate, indignant? I don't know. Okay.
I'll let the teachers out there be the judge of that.
It was for the teachers why I was saying it.
There was a lot of passion. I could really feel the passion. Almost match Mary's passion for the curlews.
Chloe, you were with me while I was doing my PGCE year. You could appreciate the energy and the emotional turmoil I went through during that year, surely.
I would not repeat that experience.
Right, if we get back to the point.
What a fantastic conversation. There are so many things that I've taken away from it, but the one thing that's had the most longevity so far, and it's such a simple concept, but it's so useful, is this idea of nature literacy.
Mm.
And I hadn't really thought about it as a construct before, but I'm finding I'm using it more and more in our everyday conversations. Like, I know, I describe us as being nature illiterate a year ago. We're now starting to learn the language.
Well, I think we're at like primary school.
Yeah.
We're like learning the shapes, learning the letters, but probably not quite competent enough to put it in the right order just yet.
What's kind of the joy though, is I feel a little bit like our oldest daughter who's 5, when she comes back and tells us about something she's learned at school and how exciting that is and what joy that brings her. And I kind of feel a bit like that when I'm getting out with nature now, because I'm connecting with it in a different way with my developing literacy skills. And it's just such a pleasure.
Yeah, one last point on that before we move on. I think, Chloe, you and I, when we were out on a walk recently along Offa's Dyke, absolutely awesome place, and we were trying to work out, again, as you do, trying to write the world's wrong. And it, as we distilled down the challenges of, so, you know, climate change, biodiversity loss, and all the other multifaceted polycrisis, as one of our guests used to say, you start distilling it down. I think we came to the conclusion, it's just education. If you had to try and solve the problem any further upstream, gets so complicated and so unlikely that distilling it down, it comes back to education. If we could just invest even more, twice the amount in education of our children, and make sure and overhaul the education system, and also then spread nature literacy throughout that as one of the many facets, I just think that's a great place to start, and would make, in just a few years, I think, make the world of difference.
It's a really interesting thought experiment, thinking, like, if I was going to redesign the education system from scratch, given what we know about climate change, biodiversity loss, the problematic situation we find ourselves in, what would that look like? And it's quite inspiring, but also quite scary how far that is
away from how we're currently educating our young people.
Yeah, I think that's a conversation for another podcast, I'm sure.
I'm sure we can find someone that could speak to that. If anyone knows anyone that would be particularly eloquent on that subject, we'd love to hear more.
My final point on Mary's chat, there were many we could discuss, but it was just when we went into the chat with Mary about curlies, I have to confess, as people will know, I'm not particularly passionate about a single animal or insect or beast. However, her ability to weave her magic over us and explain the value and importance of it and the beauty that comes with it really has converted me and just yet again shows the value of emotional intelligence, of passion in these conversations. It shouldn't all be about the data. It's about being able to convey the story in a way that people want to receive it. And it's just proven yet again in this episode.
And what I found particularly inspirational was not just Mary's passion or her expertise, but actually that resilience, that ability to sit alongside the discomfort of the struggle, knowing you've got all these systemic barriers in place to getting the GCSE sorted, the physical barriers of her walking 500 miles across the UK to promote the curlews, that awareness that if you want something that's really important to you, you're going to have to work really hard for it and tolerate that emotional discomfort along the way. And I think that's a really important message. And a useful reminder for us at times that it's supposed to be hard for us to get to where we want to get to.
Well, if it was easy, anyone would do it and we'd have the problem solved. But yes, she really, really is a warrior. And I think she's great, frankly. Mary for president.
Yes.
Right. I think that's it for this week's episode. If you've got this far, then well done. I think hopefully you've enjoyed it. There is one last thing we just want to ask is that anyone that does listen to the podcast, rating, reviewing, we say every single time, is so, so valuable to us, so valuable to our journey. Also so valuable to spreading the word of these amazing guests that we get on. So if you get to the end of this episode, if you are in a safe place, pull over or whatever, or just stop what you're doing, got it down on your phone, and just do a quick rate and review. It doesn't matter if you're on Spotify or Apple or iTunes or wherever you are, it does make a difference. Right, that's it for another week, Chloe.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening.
See you next time.